IVM. Hello, hello. We're Team Splainer. Welcome to an all-new episode of Press Decode, a weekly podcast where we take Splainer's mission to declutter the news one step further. Check out our newsletter for more stories. We've got a one-month free trial for you in the show notes, so don't forget to take us for a free spin. But for now, just sit back, relax, and don't let the news give you the blues. I'm Vagda, your host for the day, and it's just Sara and me. So we have three segments for you. In our first segment, we're unpacking what the hell is happening in Sri Lanka. For the Food for Thought segment, we put on our hoity-toity hats to decode authenticity in high art. And then in our final segment, we'll be roasting and toasting our fave and least fave items.
Okay, so let's get on with our big story. There's a very wild chance that you missed this, but in case you did, since the weekend especially, in an unprecedented show of popular rage, hundreds of thousands of Sri Lankans swarmed into Colombo to evict their president and prime minister. Now, for some context, the protest first began in March in rural areas because of the severe economic crisis and soon swept across the country. The most prominent symbol of popular rage was the Gotago village, a tent city of protesters set up at the Gale Face in Colombo, right outside the president's office. Now, former PM Mahinda Rajapaksa, who is the brother of the current president, I will tell you why I sound a little doubtful about the current state of his presidency. But basically, Mahinda tried to use goons to dismantle the campsite, but the backlash was so severe that he had to eventually resign instead. He was replaced as PM by opposition leader Ranil Wickremesinghe, who took the job in what is now understood to be a compromise intended to keep Gotabaya in power. So everyone claims that they're all hand in glove. On Saturday, things took a turn. Thousands descended on Colombo in a massive, massive protest. The police had to go as far as to use tear gas and water cannons, but all to no avail. The crowds eventually stormed the presidential palace, and that's where you saw the most bizarre scenes on social media. Right from swimming in the pool to lounging on the canopied beds, the protesters were truly living their best life. They watched cricket and, in some weird inception move, also watched news footage of themselves and other fellow protesters on TVs in the presidential palace. Some protesters, in classic mom friend style, decided to cook curries and snacks for others, while others decided that it's time to shower in bathrooms or pose for photos at the desks. All in all, it was very unreal to see. Like, I remember I was having a regular Saturday morning, and by afternoon, these pictures and videos hit social media, and I could not stop talking about it. I think the quote, however, that eventually with reporting stuck out to me, and that goes beyond the bizarreness of this move, was from a woman who said she was simply there just to know how the presidents live. And she says, "We've not seen what their lifestyle was like. I wanted to see it for myself." And I think this seemingly normal quote actually speaks volumes about the stark differences that's present in the country right now. From people having to go to the extent of skipping out on meals because running out of money and just the prices are skyrocketing, to the president living in this palatial mansion with all amenities and more. And I mean, just in case you're wondering, Wickremesinghe was not spared either, as the crowds even went to the extent of setting his residence on fire. The police claim to have arrested more than 3,000 people in connection with the protests. As luck would have it, or as the situation was, neither Rajapaksa or Wickremesinghe were at their residence during the protests. Both had gone into hiding on Friday itself, and Rajapaksa has reportedly escaped to Maldives on Wednesday, which is when he was supposedly supposed to put down his papers as president. Hence the doubt about who's president, who's not. The prime minister has now declared a state of emergency by calling himself the interim president. Now, this is a little odd because over the weekend, he also claimed that he was going to step down, and he has called himself interim president without Rajapaksa actually formally resigning.
Wait, can we call ourselves interim president of Sri Lanka?
Why not? I don't think they're looking at the law anymore.
That's true.
So, like, clearly we don't really know what's up with their government. They're claiming to resign and more than enough people are ready to stake claim to the seat of power, but no one's really ready to take responsibility for cleaning up the mess that there is. So I think before we get into what happens now, where we're now, I genuinely want to know where the country got here from and how they've even made it to this sheer mess.
Yeah, okay. So the crisis is basically that Sri Lanka is bankrupt. That is it. That is the end of it. It's been reeling under a financial crisis for over a year, but things have become way worse in the last few months. The root of its financial crisis lies in imports clubbed with mismanagement by the top leadership. It is an island country. Okay, let's begin with that. It's an island country and it relies pretty much for everything on imports for all its basic needs. It imports everything from sugar to wheat, dairy products, milk powder, medical supplies, everything. So it needs a lot of foreign exchange to pay for all that.
Medical supplies reminds me, today I actually read the most bizarre quote again of doctors saying, please don't fall sick, we don't have medicines. Which is surreal to even hear, right?
Yeah. It's a humanitarian disaster, actually.
It is.
It is. The government owes about $51 billion in foreign debt and has no money for even like interest payments. And so it recently, last week, defaulted on its payments, which is further sending its currency spiraling down and which is making food prices even higher. They've shot up by almost 80%. And this is surprising. One apple costs 200 rupees. According to the UN, 9 out of 10 families are skipping meals. So that quote from that lady who wanted to see how they live. But again, how did it come to this? So there are a bunch of factors. First, exports declined, thus messing up the balance of trade and depleting foreign currency reserves. Exports formed 39% of the GDP in the year 2000. Then they fell to 20% in 2015 and hit 16.5% in 2020. So that's like half. Despite this, successive governments continued to spend loads of money, getting foreign funding to pay for huge construction projects without the understanding that these types of investments actually only work when the economy is booming. And in reality, the economy was spiraling down. The growth rate was down to 2.3% in 2019. And then came the pandemic, hitting all three key drivers of Sri Lanka's foreign exchange earnings, which is goods, overseas remittances from workers, and tourism. And add to that, President Gotabaya, or not President Gotabaya, cut taxes on the affluent, which is reducing one more space of getting any sort of revenue, and restricted imports of essential goods like chemical fertilizers, which are used by like 90% of farmers in the country. And keep in mind, like a major chunk of Sri Lanka's export earnings come from tea. So in the absence of fertilizers, what happens to that? And then the central bank started printing money to inject cash into the market, which caused runaway inflation. All the while, the leadership under Rajapaksa's were hoping that they'll just get bailed out, you know, like every time by the IMF or China or India. And that didn't happen. So here we are. The people are pissed and want the leadership to leave, resulting in protests and culminating in the scenes that we saw over the weekend.
Wow. Yeah, I understand popular rage now. I truly do.
Yeah.
But I think it's also now fascinating, now that we're here, where do we go from here?
Yeah, like I'm not willing to be...
We know it's down in the dumps.
Yeah.
Clearly, Vagda doesn't want to be president for a reason. Clearly.
Yeah.
So here's why it is actually terrifying for anyone now. The opposition parties claim to have decided to form an all-party interim government. The people rejected it. First, the plan was that both Rajapaksa and Wickremesinghe would quit on July 13th, which is Wednesday. But then, like I pointed out, Rajapaksa seems to have fled without actually quitting. And Wickremesinghe took that opportunity to declare himself the interim president. He has now announced his willingness to also resign if consensus is reached on forming a unity government, which... I don't know, they're all just saying these things. And now, apparently, from anywhere between 3 days of when we record to 30 days, the presidential succession process could be undertaken. This is when the parliament basically elects another member of parliament to serve out Rajapaksa's term, which is supposed to end in November 2024. So the winner will basically complete the 2 years left in the term. But it isn't as simple as it seems, because it is hard to see how the MPs will select a consensus candidate who will also be acceptable to the public. Because like I said, the public outright rejected an all-party government. And it doesn't help that Rajapaksa's party still holds a majority in the parliament, which basically means that without their cooperation, the new president's position will continue to remain insecure. Analysts are also skeptical as to whether any one person can possibly appease this enraged citizenry overnight, considering like the entire political class in the country has lost public trust, and as we've seen, for good reason, which clearly spells out more chaos. Analysts are also concerned that it's important to watch out for the army, considering they have been very surprisingly and very different from character, more vocal in the wake of chaos, with General Shivendra Silva issuing appeals for calm. Now, you need to understand, he's a key ally of the Rajapakshas and was appointed Chief of Defense Staff just last month. So what does this mean? Is the army going to play an important role? Which Rajapakshas come back? But again, other analysts claim that even a Silva may not actually be enough to save the Rajapakshas back. With Gotabaya's exit, currently there is no single Rajapaksha left in power, despite them holding decades of political power in the country. And I do recommend reading our big story just to understand the sheer amount of political power this one family held. At one point, nearly 40 people of the same clan were in positions of power. In a past interview, Mahinda has actually quipped, saying, "People keep voting the Rajapaksha family members to power. What can I do? When they do not wish to see them anymore, they will kick them out. I think the time has finally come." Mm-hmm. Beyond all these internal political scuffles, the most important bit is Sri Lanka needs a stable government to be able to successfully negotiate with the International Monetary Fund and actually implement its policy recommendations, because no one else came to their rescue until now. Colombo currently requires $6 billion through the end of the year to buy just fuels and other essentials. And another $3 billion bailout is also critical. So I guess right now, since we're still in the middle of crisis and as we record, things like keep seeming to be developing in the country, I think it's just time to wait and watch for what comes next for this island nation. And I hope the people are okay.
Yeah, okay. On that note, we come to the end of our first segment. We'll be right back after a short break. You're listening to Press Decode on the IVM Podcasts Network. Hello and welcome back to Press Decode on the IVM Podcasts Network. We're Team Splainer, and in today's Food for Thought, we're looking at a crazy art story. In 1994, Stephanie Clegg paid $90,000 for a Marc Chagall painting at a Sotheby's auction, like 9 years after the artist's death. She hung that painting happily in her bedroom for years, but then she moved to a smaller house and the painting went into storage. So in 2008, she had the painting reappraised by Sotheby's, who now valued it at $100,000. All good till now. Then in 2020, Clegg wanted to sell works from her collection, so Sotheby's decided it'll be a good time to sell the Chagall, but also said that, as standard practice now, the work will have to go to France for authentication by a committee of experts on Chagall's works. So Clegg was also happy to send it, as the Sotheby's described the review as pure formality. Here is where it goes downhill. The committee of experts found the painting to be a fake. Not just that, the committee is now refusing to return the work and Chagall's heirs want it destroyed as counterfeit, which is actually something that the French law allows. Obviously, as a flabbergasted collector, Clegg went back to Sotheby's, but the auction house said that they couldn't do anything about it and pointed to the authentication guarantee, the certificate that Sotheby's provided back in 1994. To which Sotheby's said, "Oh, it's only valid for 5 years." But as a goodwill gesture, they offered $18,500 in credit, which was the amount that they earned as commission on the sale in 1994. But Clegg has asked Sotheby's for $175,000, a claim that Sotheby's says there is no legal ground for. Now, I don't know who's really in the right here. So what do you think? Sotheby's should be responsible in this case, or shall I just tell Clegg to, you know, deal with it?
Sucks to suck. But so the story actually had me like cackling for the first 5 minutes, because as we have established, I do not understand art to save my life, nor do I understand why people pay this money. But like, can you imagine spending that much money and then finding out it was all in vain? Like, mind-boggling.
It
is. But then the inner nerd eventually took over. And I was very fascinated to know that the genuineness of art is actually surprisingly fluid. You wouldn't think so, right? Like, you'd think, okay, now that I know it's an original, it continues to remain original, as common judge would govern. Apparently not. Actually, even genuineness of art changes over time, and hence the changing valuations. Hence, it got appraised and whatnot. Now, a curator at the Met actually explains this very simply by saying that attributions for art are not much different to medicine or any other field in which knowledge is constantly changing or advancing. So it isn't like Sotheby's was actively duping poor Stephanie, but it was simply that this was the best that they knew at the time, and hence the certificate that they give. Now, I don't necessarily understand why the piece needs to be destroyed, considering the fluidity of art could well mean that the piece could once again live as an authentic work months or years from now. Who's really to say? But beyond that, Sotheby's continues to claim that they are in the legal right, and they have good reason to argue so. They claim that since it's been more than 20 years since the original sale, they're actually outside the period of any legal liability over their stamp of approval about the authenticity of any work that they sell. Like you've mentioned, they warrant their work only for 5 years. And then came all the good PR strategy of a goodwill gesture. So now you can read specific arguments that both parties have used in an NYT report that I will link below. But having read everything on a big picture view, I do surprisingly believe that art houses aren't necessarily in the wrong in a situation like this. My sympathies for the art collector aside, the fact of the matter is we are getting too darn good at creating dupes. So how do you expect them to actually sniff it out? So I actually read about someone called Han Wen Migren. Forgive me for pronouncing this incorrectly, because I am 100% sure I am, who is often dubbed as one of the greatest art forgers in history. He was able to create Vermeer's work with such expertise that even when he admitted to be a forger, experts refused to believe him. It was not until he actually recreated one of the works under the watchful eye of a court that he was credited with his famous forgeries. Like, can you imagine saying,
"Wow,
no, I am a chore. No, you can't be. No, trust me. No." I refuse to believe. But eventually the prices for all those pieces fell drastically. And now here's the kicker. This was back in 1945. So if he could manage this back then, imagine just how good forgery would be now. Like, they would have seriously upped their game by now. Mm-hmm. So personally for me, it all boils down to, as an art noob, it's beyond me to understand why there is such a premium on authenticity, especially on visual art. I mean, you get the vibes by looking at it now. How does this matter? Like, I apologize, okay, for all the very cultured, art-friendly people, including Wagner. But it's beyond me. And I also don't, like, sure as hell don't understand why someone would be willing to dole out, like, silly money for it, when it's clearly these art collectors know the fact that authenticity is eventually so fluid, right? Like, I didn't know until now, but now that I know that, even a potential art collecting streak is killed.
That's the thing. I am on the other side. Like, I'm on the side of the art collector here, because I am being told that it is authentic. And authenticity has the premium, as much as you don't understand or don't want to believe that there is a premium for it. Authenticity is the main reason for something being valued at like crazy $450 million, you know, dollars. So as a big established auction house that builds itself as an expert, such that an amateur art collector like me, I would rely on your judgment. And everybody does. Like Sotheby's, Christie's, these are not just platforms for sale, you know. They're not Amazon, you know. So they do their due diligence to establish authenticity and issue certificates of authenticity.
Amazon also has like return policy. Where is the return policy here?
Yeah. No, but Amazon also has a 30-day return policy. They have a 5-year return policy.
I mean, but also the amount of money involved.
And also that you're issuing a certificate of authenticity. Exactly. It's not even like, I don't know. It's not like, scratch that also. Yeah. So since knowing that there are amateur art collectors who are depending on Sotheby's and Christie's for their expertise, US laws saw it. They recognized it way like back in the 1970s. They saw the level of information asymmetry between auction houses and collectors and established some sort of responsibility on the auction house that is what actually led to Sotheby's and Christie's coming up with limitation clauses of some sort, you know, because there was now a responsibility on their part to be liable for misattribution. This 5 years thing is something that they came up with after the laws came. So, and they also refuse to grant authenticity to anything produced after 1870, because it's harder for them to authenticate works prior to that. Which brings me to a very basic question. How can a certificate of authenticity have a time limit? I know you said that it's a dynamic, fluid type of thing, but just how?
This is the situation, right?
When it's a bit, think about it. It's a bit ridiculous. Like it's you told me that this is a Chagall painting 9 years after his death. And then I bought it for $90,000. And now you're telling me that it's fake. It's not Chagall. It's not a washing machine that will have a limited period of operation, you know?
I mean, that's funny.
It's a certificate of authenticity.
Like, what if a forger just comes and says, listen, by the way, I did it. Like, what are you going to say? No, you didn't. Situations like that do arise, as I have established.
So then what is this 5 years limitation? Why provide any authenticity? Like, why provide any guarantee of authentication, right?
For that, your guess is as good as mine.
It's like, if I am a collector, and if at any point I want to sell my collection, I must do it in those 5 years. And like every year right before it is 5 years, I will come to Sotheby's again and be like, okay, listen, I want to sell it now. Because in the sixth year, I can't. What if it turns out to be fake? And that doesn't make me much of a collector. Or I sell it in the fifth year and I purchase it myself. Every time paying them what, $18,500 or more now as commission every single time. It doesn't make me a collector. Then it makes me, I don't know, a seller. I'll just keep track of, oh, when is the authenticity running out? I must buy or like sell it before that. And like scholars in the field say authenticity is pretty subjective and it will change with experts. But it's so absurd that a hugely, like insanely priced exclusive club that is high art is set on claims of authenticity, which are so prone to change. I don't know. It's just ridiculous. Spending this huge amount on something, which may be nothing after a while, and it's happened many times before. Like in another relatively recent case, this painting titled Salvatore Mundi, which sold at an auction in 2005 for $1,100 when it was thought to be by a nobody, later sold for $450 million, same painting, in 2017. After experts decided that it was actually a work of Leonardo da Vinci of Mona Lisa fame.
I'm sorry, I just have to laugh. I think it's the first time in my life I've heard his name and go of Mona Lisa fame, just in case.
And I read that there are many, many more cases like this, not all of which come to the public knowledge because, you know, it's high art, remember? It's like collectors who are duped like this, many times they settle outside of court because of the embarrassment of being duped.
Valid.
But the thing is, despite US laws on the subject, which are actually pretty vague and old, courts have not given a clear view on the law either as to who is responsible. They have been more giving towards amateur art collectors in cases of misattribution before, for the main reason that they rely on the auction house's expertise. So this is kind of determined by court. So if you're an experienced art collector, you may not get that kind of treatment from court. You may be told, deal with it. But the law is not settled, and scholars argue with all kinds of theories of liability. One of those is that auction houses should be strictly liable, which is liable regardless of whose fault it is. Because for a collector to prove negligence in due diligence on part of the huge auction house, it's extremely hard and expensive. So it's just easier and streamlined. And as I always bat for the underdog, I don't know how much of an underdog you are if you can spend $90,000 on an art piece. But in any case, in this case, you are. And it's easier. It's just easier for auction houses to be doing their due diligence, and negligence is hard to prove. And also, you can just insure this, you know, ensure it can be covered under insurance because it doesn't happen all that often, I'm guessing.
I'm hoping. Can you imagine?
Yeah. I can't actually, because we don't really know the numbers.
Yeah.
Maybe this is how we get to know the numbers.
Well, on that note, we come to the end of this segment. We'll be right back after a short break. You're listening to Press Decode on the IVM Podcast Network. Well, Welcome back to Press Decode on the IVM Podcast Network. It's time for our final segment this week, Roast or Toast. And in a very surprising turn of events, we are just, I think, standing by Vagda's words, and we only have fave items this week.
Yes, as head of positivity at Press Decode, I'm mandated out of plain whim that this week we will only have fave items. So here we are with two faves of the week. I will start. It's yet another art story because somehow that is the theme. We obviously have our hoity-toity hats on.
Come in here and say, Vagda had the hoity-toity hat and I was unwillingly, it's just placed on my head. And the only reason I was here is because, like I said, the absurdity of spending $90,000 and then realizing it's for no reason is the only reason why I was delighted in art. Moving on.
Yes. This will delight you even more. An art collective called Mischief, M-S-C-H-F, is doing a very interesting roaming art experiment for 3 days in the US. What is it called? Eat the Rich, which entails selling $10 popsicles of 5 kind. What kind, you say? Of the planet's wealthiest men. The collective is selling popsicles shaped in the faces of Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Ma, and Bill Gates. And each is called Bite Bezos, Munch Musk, Snack on Jack, and Gobble Gates. Now, I'm just waiting for someone to make one Graze on Mukesh or Glut on Gautam, because why should our Ambani Adani motorbikes be trailing in this respect? Ah, such a delightful story.
What a delightful item. Correct. Oh, I'm going to be first in line for Graze on Mukesh. Thank you. Make it happen, Vagda. Make it happen.
Okay.
My absolute fave item, since we were mandated to have fave items, was once again staying in the realm of corn and forgery. So forget Russian corn artists like Anna Sorokin or even poor old Stephanie and her Chagall. But no one can quite pull off a scam like the Jagadu Indian. Villagers in Gujarat staged an elaborate fake IPL to steal money from Russian bookies. And here's how it worked. I have to quote this straight because I can't say it with a straight face and not miss out on details. So nearly 2 dozen farmers and other unemployed youth in Molipur donned the Chennai Super Kings, Mumbai Indians, Gujarat Titans and other IPL teams' jerseys and took turns playing. Some pretended to be umpires. There was even someone who had the wonderful skill of being able to mimic the popular commentator Harsha Bhogle. The matches were filmed on 5 HD cameras and streamed live on YouTube, complete with fake sound effects of ambient audience cheers. They then proceeded to solicit bets through a Telegram channel and had received upwards of 3 lakhs through Havala couriers. And my mind is blown at like, just how they could pull it off. I mean, imagine, right? IPL's like for IPL broadcast rights, people are once again playing silly, silly money. And here are dudes in this tiny Molipur managed to do it on the bare minimum. All was going well until the police got a whiff of this piece of ingenuity and shut it down. I call them total buzzkills, but
I totally agree with you.
The law and whatnot.
Oh, damn. This is what we don't need the law for.
Right? Thank you. Great. Great way to end like the episode on, right? Just law, why? Just a little scam is okay.
And it's not just like little scam. It's little scamming Russians.
I'm not saying anything.
What? Russia's our friend. Is that it? What?
Why won't... Nah, I'm not...
Okay, fine. Don't say anything. And that was our show this week. Thank you so much for joining us on Press Decode. You can catch us every Thursday on the IVM Podcasts Network. And guys, please remember, don't let the news give you the blues.